It's 6 minutes past 10 o'clock. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. Well, starting today, representatives from about 190 countries around the world are meeting in Bangkok to talk about climate change. And then in December, another group is going to be meeting in Copenhagen. And the hope is to have some sort of international agreement on climate change before the end of 2009. And we're going to talk about the likelihood of that happening and about the state of the discussion worldwide about climate change in this hour of the program. And to help us do that, I'm joined by phone by Gregory F. Nemeth, Assistant Professor of Public Affairs and Environmental Studies at the La Follette School of Public Affairs at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Professor, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, John. Good morning.
Well, last week, Ban Ki-moon had some meetings with people in sort of an attempt to jumpstart the talks, which start today. What's exactly going on in Bangkok this week? What are they trying to do?
Well, they're trying to set the stage for what's going to happen in that meeting you mentioned in December in Copenhagen. And just to give a little bit of longer-term perspective, this is the process that started really around 1992, to find a way to get the world to agree on a way to reduce emissions of greenhouse gases and deal with climate change. And it's been kind of a long process, and these meetings are incredibly difficult because the problem itself is difficult, and you've got this issue of 150 or so countries that have to somehow come to an agreement. So we've got these sort of large, important, high-profile meetings that have been happening just about once a year or so since 1992. And in the interim, there have been sort of sub-meetings of people trying to set the agenda and sort of set up the major meetings so that they're sort of focused on a few key issues and that they don't succumb to the temptation of having 160 countries kind of bickering about details and not really getting anywhere over the course of maybe 7 or 10 days that will happen in December. So the last week's meeting in New York and then this week's meeting in Bangkok are part of this kind of interim process to set the stage to try to come to some substantive agreement in December in Copenhagen.
Well, there are a lot of issues to be resolved. The summary of news reporting about this issue and about these meetings kind of stakes out one of the issues as being rich countries versus poor countries.
Yep. Yeah. So that's a good way to put it: rich countries versus poor countries. And we could probably separate that into a few, just a little bit more detail and categorization helps quite a bit on this issue. So we've got rich versus poor, and basically the rich countries are countries that emit a lot of greenhouse gas emissions but are also wealthy, and the poor countries haven't become wealthy yet and see their way that they'll become as wealthy as the rich countries is by consuming more energy and getting people to use cars and have increased mobility and increased consumption of fossil fuels, which is the path that that developed countries today have gotten rich by. So that's sort of the problem there, is you've got the rich and the poor. If you separate it out a few different ways, it gets a little bit more complicated, but also there's a little bit more for opportunity for some kind of cooperation here. So the first thing is probably to focus on two countries, the U.S. and China, that emit something like 40% of greenhouse gases. China last year surpassed the U.S. as the biggest emitter in the world of greenhouse gases. So you've got two big countries, one of which is undoubtedly rich, and the other one is becoming rich. At least part of the country is actually quite rich, and the rest of the country is not. And so it's sort of not really accurate to put China in the poor country picture, but it's not entirely a rich country either. So China's crucial and sort of fits in between this rich and poor divide. So we've got the U.S., we've got and China, which notably did not sign on to the last agreement on reducing greenhouse gas emissions that really was agreed on in 1997 and ratified in 2005. So they're sort of big, important outliers that haven't adopted any meaningful commitments. Then we've got a group of rich countries that did sign the last climate change agreement in 2005, mostly Western Europe, Japan, Canada, Australia, a few countries like that. Then we've got some other becoming rich countries that aren't really rich yet that could be important, but not as important as China. That would be Brazil, Russia, and India. So those are important ones. And then we've got you could call it the rest of the world, which their economic development is crucial because there are a lot of people there, but their sort of aggregate greenhouse gas emissions aren't that big and probably won't that be that big for quite a while. So they're kind of less of a concern. And so there's some sense that they could be allowed to develop on, at least in the interim, on sort of a path that prioritizes development, getting out of poverty, and not so much on reducing greenhouse gases. But the other ones, U.S., China, and probably also Brazil, Russia, and India have to do something if we're going to deal with this problem.
But there's another group of poor countries as well who are countries where the effects of climate change are being felt and they don't have the resources to deal with them. For example, the fact that sea level is rising, there's an island nation in the Pacific that's about to be flooded out of existence.
Yep. And that's certainly one of the hardest parts about it. Like I said at the beginning, this is a really difficult problem. One of the most difficult aspects of the climate change issue is the places that are going to be most impacted, at least in the near term, are also kind of the poorest countries and the ones that are least able to do something about it. And sort of in climate change policy jargon, there's a distinction between mitigation, which means reducing the amount of the climate change problem, and adaptation, which means finding ways to deal with the effects of climate change, some of which will be inevitable. And it's that second part, adaptation, that's really crucial for those countries that you mentioned, these poor countries that are already starting to endure some of the effects, such as rising sea levels, but also poor countries tend to be more reliant on things like agriculture that are just, for physical reasons, more susceptible to the climate problem. So that's one of the biggest issues here between rich and poor, is that the damages, at least in the near term, are likely to have a bigger effect on the on poor countries than rich countries.
There was an article in the New York Times last week that was talking about, you know, the world leaders are meeting at the United Nations, but they were talking about how momentum on this climate change pact is becoming an issue because temperatures have been relatively stable for a decade and may even drop in the next few years. And that, of course, that always fuels the discussion, well, is climate change really happening or not? And it makes it perhaps a little more difficult to get anything done.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. That's another aspect of the problem that makes it hard, and I feel like I'm kind of listing and emphasizing the parts of the problem that make it hard and difficult, and it's not to say that we shouldn't solve the problem. In fact, it means we should work even harder to do so. But this is part of it, is that climate change is a long-term problem. It's solving it is going to take a long time, and there's nothing irreversible about deciding to take on the problem and deal with it. And so whatever we do in terms of finding a solution to climate change has got to endure for a long period of time, and it's got to endure among competing social priorities. We're inevitably going to have financial crises, wars, concern about other aspects of the economy, whether it be healthcare or education or other social priorities that will come up from time to time. And whatever we decide to do on climate change has got to continue to be in place when we have these other challenges come up. And so that puts pressure on people thinking that this is an important problem and one we're going to have to deal with. And you're right. It does seem at least highly possible that in the next, say, 5 or 10 years, the rapid increase in global surface temperatures that have been observed might actually slow down and stabilize for something like 10 years for something that has nothing to do with emissions of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, but just have to do with sort of idiosyncrasies of the climate system. And so whatever we decide to do in the next 10 years may have to be done in the context of a problem that doesn't seem to be getting worse, at least in the near term, but that's not connected to the impacts in the longer term. And in this case, the longer term is maybe 10 years in the future. So whatever we decide to do is going to have to be kind of robust to the possibility of maybe having some kind of stabilization in the near term.
Let me give the phone numbers, and then we have some people who have found their way to the phone without my giving the phone numbers, we'll take some calls. 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. That's the toll-free number to use to get into the program. And if you'd like to send us an email, the address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Let's take a call from Mike in Butler. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. I hope you can hear me. I'm calling from a payphone, and it's quite windy out here today. I have so much to say, but my first comment is I've been in the energy field for 40 years, working to save energy, and renewables for the last 30. My opinion is that we can't afford 10 years. The 50-year plan that the Sierra Club seems to come up with, let's assume that we already passed the tipping point, which some scientists believe we are. And I went to Alaska to take a fact-finding tour, and I tell you, the glacier up the Mendenhall Glacier near Juneau, Alaska, which usually loses 50 feet a year, last year lost 500 feet. And if that doesn't scare you, I don't know what will. But I think we have a solution here, and we need to get our environmental groups on the same page. We need to cut massive amounts of energy. When I talk massive, 50% of our energy in this country is being squandered. And if we don't do it in the next 3 to 5 years, I don't think we're going to have a long-term solution, because we're already having accelerated results of climate change. The 16 inches of rain that hit Thailand. We've had 200-year floods back-to-back here in southeastern Wisconsin. And then we had drought for 40 days. So you talk about schizophrenia of the climate. That's already happening, and I think it's going to continue. But my main point is, all the feel-good renewable energy in the world, this is not going to be a popular statement, but we cannot afford to put up feel-good renewables that are very, very expensive compared to conservation and efficiency, which is the only solution by far in the next short term. And people who say we can do both don't realize that money doesn't grow on trees. If you can't save the energy, you're not going to, what use does it do to generate new electricity if the ones that you've got you're squandering? So I basically want to put in a plug for, you know, the well-intentioned but naive environmentalists who think that we can put solar panels up and solve climate change need to get in touch with people who are actually in the field and cutting our national energy use at least by 50% so we get back to the 1970 levels will only slow the results. They will not mitigate it or reverse it, and I think we need to talk about stopping climate change basically by getting rid of coal-fired power plants, going to natural gas, which is now abundant and clean, but so many things have to happen so fast that we can't delay.
Thanks for the call, Mike. A lot to chew on there. How do we get to climate change programming that's actually going to work without perhaps making some rather significant sacrifices, as our caller was suggesting? We need to cut our energy usage by 50%. That seems like a lot.
Yeah, right. So that's going down key to the challenge. So the first thing that Mike, the caller, talked about was this issue of tipping points and irreversibility, and that's becoming more and more of a problem that's being incorporated into the policy discussion. There's this sentiment that the climate system itself is what some people call twitchy. It responds kind of disproportionately to a small change. And so if some of those changes to the climate system put it in adverse social directions, we could be in trouble on a pretty short time scale. And so there is an urgency that's driven not so much by the projections over the next 50 years or so, but by the potentially low but very high impact scenarios in which we have some kind of positive feedback mechanism that gets into that goes forward. So that's certainly an issue and a reason to act faster than we otherwise would. In terms of the actual solutions, one of the main aspects of the color solution was that we're not going to have a single approach to this problem. We're going to have many different approaches. And in terms of some people also say we don't want to have a silver bullet solution, but we want to have a silver buckshot solution, that we need quite a few different solutions, but all of them have to be important and potentially big on their own, because the problem itself is so big. And certainly, there are lots of low, zero, and maybe even negative cost solutions that would help us reduce energy use and reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And those have to do with energy efficiency improvements, a lot of which we've adopted, and some of which Wisconsin is especially well known for. But there's certainly a lot more what's called low-hanging fruit, a lot more opportunities to use less energy and to emit greenhouse gas emissions as a result. So that's certainly almost a no-brainer that we should do more of that. What becomes hard and difficult is to say how much opportunity there is at what cost to do these efforts at conservation and reducing energy use. And at some point, that reduction in energy use starts to become difficult or costly, and then we need other solutions as well. And there's no one out there claiming that we can solve our climate solution, solve our climate problem by just by cutting energy use and imposing energy efficiency. So we need other things as well. And it seems probably best at this point to hedge our bets by having a lot of solutions out there and seeing which ones pan out. Renewables, as the caller suggested, are expensive today, especially if we deployed them on a much, much larger scale, which we would need to be. But they're getting cheaper all the time. And so there's potential that that could actually be a low-cost solution, even if it's not right now. But then other solutions as well, switching from coal to natural gas seems like an appealing one because we wouldn't have to completely change our infrastructure, although that does mean a lot more competition for a limited natural gas resource. So that probably would have its own cost impact at some point as well.
Well, and it's still a short-term solution. I mean, at some point, the natural gas is going to be gone, and then what do you got?
Right. So a lot of these solutions are really buying time, and there is a real value to buying time because at some point we're going to have something that's much bigger and more radical in terms of the way we use and consume energy, and those might have to do with finding ways to combust coal and somehow keep it from going into the atmosphere, maybe turning it into a substance that would be held underneath the ground or underneath the ocean. We might need ways to actually suck CO2 out of the atmosphere on its own in ambient concentrations and then put it somewhere else that's not going to heat up the globe. So that, again, means putting it underneath the ground or underneath the oceans. And then, you know, there's higher-tech renewable solutions that have the potential to offer very cheap energy with very little emissions in terms of greenhouse gases. So in the longer term, we've got to get some of these bigger, more radical solutions to work because the changes to the energy system required to address climate change are not incremental. They're gigantic.
We need to take a break, and when we come back, we'll have more with our guests. We're talking about the topic of climate change. Specifically, there's a meeting that started today in Bangkok that's kind of a precursor to another meeting that will happen in Copenhagen later in 2009. There seems to be some urgency about getting global agreement on climate change and what we ought to do about it. And that's what we're talking about this hour. You can join us at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, or you can send an email. The address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. My guest this hour is Gregory Nemeth, Assistant Professor of Public Affairs and Environmental Studies at the La Follette School of Public Affairs at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 25 minutes after 10 o'clock. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Before we go back into our program, I just want to say, hey, thanks. You've taken a day off our fall pledge drive. If you've been listening regularly, you know that for every 700 donations, we're taking a day off the fall pledge drive. Well, you can help make it two by making your donation today. Join the 879 contributors who have already helped by going to WPR.org to take days off by donating now. Believe me, we like the idea of taking days off pledge drive as much as you do. This hour, we're talking about climate change. Gregory Nemeth is Assistant Professor of Public Affairs and Environmental Studies at the La Follette School of Public Affairs at the UW-Madison. He's my guest by phone, and John in Onalaska also wants to join in the discussion. John, good morning.
Hi, good morning. I wish you'd comment on my thought. I was thinking of the, you know, what would be one simple thing that would do a lot of, give us a lot of benefit. And maybe this, I could buy a fuel-saving car, or maybe I could, use the solar energy. But I think the simple and single most important thing would be to have one less child. I think the biggest problem we have is adding population. Each person in this country consumes more and more energy. And, if we just cut the number of people, we will not have to perhaps reduce our standard of living so much in order to maintain this environment. What do you think?
Yeah, no doubt. If everyone had one less child, something like one child instead of two, if everyone around the world did that, instead of having about 6.8 million billion people today increasing to about 9 billion by mid-century, we'd be increasing to something like 7.5 or 8 billion, and that would make all of the impacts we're talking about a lot less of a problem and would be certainly part of the solution, although that certainly wouldn't be its own solution. But in terms of, say, maybe having 8 or 9 very substantial changes to the way we use and consume energy, that would be one on par with expanding renewables a lot, having much more efficient vehicles, maybe having preventing deforestation, having nuclear power on a larger scale than we have today. So all of those solutions are kind of that silver buckshot approach, a lot of several different solutions, but each one is large. And if we did have fewer people, that would sort of be on par with that. And there's been some work that's looked at population reduction or population growth moderation programs, and the impact seem to be on par with the other ones I just mentioned. So, yeah, certainly that could be a big one.
Well, going back to the previous caller's point about energy reduction and needing to use less energy, I interviewed somebody recently who said, hey, you know, all these alternative energy, renewable energy things, they all sound really great, but they don't really produce that much energy. And you look at, for example, Texas, which has been held up as an example of, you know, let's put up wind power. Well, they supposedly have all these wind turbines, but the problem is that they can't be counted on to produce the energy that's actually needed. And I forget what the term is. I think there's a term for demand. Yeah, and really the truth is we're using a lot of energy and we can't count on renewables to fill the gap in the foreseeable future.
Yeah, so for one thing, renewables now are quite small. So in terms of sort of global electricity production, we're talking about something like 1 or 2% from wind and solar and that kind of thing. So no doubt, we're not going to solve the problem by the amount of renewables we have now. So we'd have to scale them up a lot. And one of the negative aspects of renewables is they're not what's called dispatchable. We can't just turn up the natural gas plant like a wind plant. We can't just turn it on. It's up to the wind to be windy or the sun to be sunny to do that. And so that's a challenge. But the way to interpret that is not that that is a deal killer for renewables. It means that you have to invest in other components of the system to make it viable. You probably have to build more electricity transmission so that you can get power from where it's windy and not just rely on one place. We might ultimately need some type of storage system. That's probably one of these longer-term solutions. If you could store this intermittent energy that comes from renewables, we'd be in much better shape to take advantage of it. And then you can also complement renewables with other parts of the system. So we talked about switching from coal to natural gas. So if you were able to do that, if you had more natural gas and were able to turn on natural gas plants when it wasn't windy, you could manage a much higher penetration of renewables. But
I guess I'll just make
is that we've got maybe 2% renewables in several parts of the country here. Some countries in Europe, northern parts of Germany and Denmark, are making 50% of their electricity at different times of the year from wind power alone. And they found ways to deal with it. It makes it more expensive to find ways to integrate it into the rest of the grid. But it's not that much more expensive. It's something like 10 or 15% more expensive to build the transition.
But, I mean, ultimately, we're going to have to reduce our appetite for electricity.
We will ultimately have to reduce our appetite for electricity, and we will have to do many other things as well. That won't do it on its own.
Let's see. Richard in Fish Creek, you're next. Good morning.
Good morning. I wanted to suggest a method for CO2 storage other than beneath the ground or ocean. My company, Scientific Eco Solutions, is promoting a plan to capture CO2 from hydrogen and ammonia plants, the amount that's put into the atmosphere every day is 25 million tons just from some of the industrialized countries. Well, anyway, the CO2, if it's captured, even for new hydrogen production, can be moved by transit in gas tankers or land gas tankers as liquid CO2 and then taken to a facility which will make it into dry ice, and dry ice can now be made in very large chunks, and it can be made in just a few minutes by pouring this into a dry ice press at 130 below zero and then transporting it to a cooling tower And the cooling tower will keep the dry ice under pressure so that it doesn't evaporate quickly, and the cold will diffuse to the outside of it. And the outer chambers of the cooling tower can have Stirling engines attached to them, which can produce electricity even several hundred degrees below zero because they use graphite. And the Stirling engines will be able to produce electricity while the cooling tower is cooling the atmosphere. And this program would be very expensive, but that's one way to combat warming is with virtual cold.
Professor?
Yeah, so that sounds like an exciting solution. And, again, I guess three things I'll say about that solution. One is it brings up this issue that we're at the point where we need to let 1,000 flowers bloom and probably 1,000,000 flowers bloom. We need lots of ideas. This sounds like a really interesting, exciting one. And it's not that hard to invest in lots of early-stage ideas like this. We've actually got at the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies at the Center for Sustainability and the Global Environment, we're running what's called the Climate Leadership Challenge. We're offering 100,000 awards to students at UW to come up with solutions like this. And this type of solution would be a great one. I would love to give an award for that. So that's the type of ideas and sort of taking full advantage of innovation and ideas like this that we're going to need on a massive scale to deal with this problem. In terms of this particular solution, I guess the two other things I'd say on it is, one, you ultimately need to be careful about keeping track of where that CO2 goes. So it's got to end up somewhere, and it's got to end up not in the atmosphere. And so that's one thing that we have to really be careful of, even if we're taking advantage of some of the benefits of taking energy out of that in that process that the caller mentioned. And two, we've got to be careful about these solutions that attempt to sort of modify the climate in an opposite direction from what greenhouse gases do. It sometimes comes under the kind of the loaded term of geoengineering, but this would be it would fit into that category where we might take advantage of some of the cooling energy he talked about in the dry ice to offset some of the warming effects of climate change. And the important aspect here is we're talking about a global problem and global solution. So if we're going to be doing any type of global cooling, it's going to have to happen on a massive level globally, and then we have to be really careful about side effects. So that's another thing that's come into the debate as we think about how difficult this problem has been to solve. Some of the solutions that are coming up now aren't directly attached to modifying the way in we use and produce energy, but have to do with modifying the amount of energy that's getting stored and trapped in the Earth's atmosphere. And these have potentially large side effects that may be worth it or may not be, but they're going to have to take serious consideration if we're going to adopt any type of geoengineering solutions on a large scale.
I'd like to go back for just a moment to kind of where we started this discussion. There are these meetings going on in Bangkok that will continue for the next 2 weeks. I think they go through October 9th, so they're meeting for a couple of weeks. Now, as I understand it, and I'd like to get this clarified, what they're trying to do here is to come up with some preliminary language for an agreement that will then be supposedly hammered out and completed, hopefully, in Copenhagen in December. They're talking about representatives from 190 countries that are working on this preliminary document. That seems like an awful unwieldy number of people to try to come up with anything. But then who will be involved in the meetings in Copenhagen? Is it a smaller group there? What are the mechanics of this?
Yeah, so that's a good point you brought up, is the number of countries that are involved. And yes, at Copenhagen, this is under the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change that was begun in 1992. And every country has a seat at the table in this case. So it's 190 countries. It's 190 delegations there. Each of them has a say in contributing to the language. And as you talked about in Bangkok, we're talking about sort of setting up some preliminary language that can be debated in Copenhagen in December. The last large climate meeting like this, well, the last important one was 2 years ago in Bali, and there was a substantial negotiation about whether there should be a comma in one sentence that had affected whether developing countries would have access to financial resources for technology development. And so it comes down to some pretty small pretty large arguments about pretty small details. And so hopefully by doing some of these preliminary negotiations and wordsmithing, we can make it less vulnerable to some of these technicalities at the December conference. But
well,
hopefully make progress on that.
According to the Reuters report that I read last night, it says more than 2,000 delegates in Bangkok will try to trim a 180-page draft into a more manageable document that lays out how all nations can curb the pace of climate change.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds just, I hate to be a cynic, but man, that just sounds like an impossible task.
It does. It does sound really hard. And so the 2,000 you mentioned is you've got 190 countries, but then you've got participation by other important voices as well. And these are often come under the category of non-governmental organizations. So they're environmental organizations or potentially interest groups for industries and things like that also have not a seat at the negotiating table, but they're able to participate in these conferences to speak with delegations sort of outside the main meetings and have a presence as well. But you're right, ultimately we've got to get a document that's signed by this large group of countries. And that has... That problem that you've talked about has sparked this debate about whether this UN forum is really the best way to deal with this problem. It's hard on its own, and the fact that we've got 190 countries makes it even harder. And honestly, it makes it vulnerable to countries that have a stake in not having anything go forward, whether they're small or large important countries. They actually have sort of disproportionate power to sort of veto this thing. And the whole organization is kind of vulnerable to what's considered the lowest common denominator problem. Any agreement that comes out will probably be set by the ambitions of the least ambitious state there. And so that's a problem. And so on the other hand, we've got smaller groups of countries working in a parallel process that might be considered sort of a bottom-up process, where you have a smaller group of countries trying to come up with something that doesn't have this this least common denominator problem.
Well, and then you also have, I mean, you have the problem that each one of these countries has an internal political dynamic as well. I mean, this isn't just an international problem. I mean, there are, for example, the resistance of the United States government in power at the time of the Kyoto Protocols was the economic cost to the United States if, you know, to take action on reducing CO2 emissions. And so for the Obama administration, there's a political calculation that they're going to have to make. How much will be tolerated by the political structure in the United States? How much can they give away, or how much can they give up? How many promises can they make if it's going to come back and cost us something in terms of the economy, particularly given where our economy is right now?
Absolutely, and domestic politics is crucial for the delegations of each of these countries. None of these countries is really able to do something important and proactive that goes against popular sentiment in their countries, especially if they think it actually might work. If they think it might not actually work, there may be a rhetorical benefit into doing that. But the U.S. example is probably the best one, and probably the biggest, for me, the biggest tempering of enthusiasm for what's supposed to come out of Copenhagen is if you look at U.S. historical environmental policy over the last 30 or 35 years, there's almost no case in which the U.S. has adopted a binding international commitment without having some domestic legislation first. And there have been cases in which it did have domestic legislation and it did do something very important internationally. We saw that on the ozone protocols in the 1980s. We saw that on dealing with acid rain as well. But on climate change, the U.S. has no federal legislation on climate change, and thus it's unlikely to be able to ratify any agreement at the U.N. because it needs a two-thirds majority in the Senate to do so. And if we can't get something passed domestically, we're very unlikely to be able to get that type of ratification of an international treaty. So that really points the finger at the U.S. federal government, and especially at this point, in particular at the U.S. Senate, to do something first.
Well, and in the United States, you still have a significant number of groups and individuals who question whether the science behind climate change is accurate, making other claims, and some going so far as to say it's some big conspiracy on the left, and so forth, and other people who've just gotten fed up and said, you know what, I'm not going to believe any of you people because I don't understand any of this. It's too complicated for me. Go away. I've got some reality TV to watch.
Yeah, so I think the second consideration is probably is definitely a more legitimate one than the first one. So the science is very complicated and is often portrayed in a confusing way, and we have to somehow overcome that issue. The first one, though, to deny that there's a problem and to say that there's a conspiracy, I think is much more rooted to some very narrow private interests that might get adversely affected by some kind of decision to reduce greenhouse gas emissions than it does to a true reading of the science. At this point, you can't deny that the climate is changing. It's almost impossible to deny that the human activity has been sort of the main culprit in terms of the change we've seen over the last 150 years. How much it's going to change, how expensive or difficult it would be to do something about the climate change is a real legitimate source of uncertainty. And I think that feeds into this confusion and sense of what do I do about it that a lot of people face in this decision. But to say that there is not a problem is really not a legitimate stance at this point.
We have callers who want to join us. We'll get to calls when we come back after this break. We're talking about climate change. There's a conference that started today in Bangkok that goes through the 9th of October, which is a precursor to another conference that will take place in Copenhagen in December. And the idea is to achieve some sort of global agreement on climate change and what to do about it. We're talking about that this morning. Still an open phone line for you if you'd like to call us at 800-486-8655, or you can send an email anytime, talk@WPR.org. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 1045. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay tuned. After 11, Larry Mueller will be in, and he'll be talking about melanomas, how to recognize them, and how to treat them. That's coming up after 11 this morning with Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. And by the way, here's our count in the Take Days Off campaign. If you, in case you just joined us, you've been gone for the last couple of months. Well, we're taking a day off the fall pledge drive for every 700 donations we get between now and then. And we've already passed that 700 mark, so we've already taken one day off. We're looking to get to 2 days off. We are at 879 contributions toward that goal. So every time you go to WPR.org and make a donation, you can help us take days off our fall membership drive. This hour, we're talking about climate change, and my guest is Gregory Nemeth, Assistant Professor of Public Affairs and Environmental Studies at the La Follette School of Public Affairs at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I mentioned we had callers. Let's go to the phones, and let's take a call from Ted in Platteville.
Hi there. How are you this morning?
Pretty good. Go ahead.
Hey, yes. By the way, I agree with your last comment about I'm one of those who believe that climate change is happening. I'm just not too sure that it isn't within the realms of what has happened in the past over the millions of years. But you talk about renewables, and there's one renewable that you leave off the table, and it's nuclear. And I'm wondering why that is not considered a renewable. It is a renewable, and it emits no CO2. So that should be on the table. The problems with it are not as difficult as the problems with most of the other things you're talking about. I have been involved with the Department of Energy for over 30 years.
Yep. So I agree. The problem is so big, and the solutions, we're going to need so many solutions that I really don't think we can take anything off the table at this point. We might be able to afford to delay large-scale deployment of some of these solutions that we think might have problems associated with them. But to take anything off the table at this point, I don't think is wise and something we can really afford to do. And just one distinction on nuclear power, it is a greenhouse gas-free energy source as long as you don't count the energy that's used to create the concrete for the containment vessel and things like that. But that's a pretty small amount relative to how much electricity it'll produce. So it really is a almost
carbon-free energy source, but it's not renewable in the sense that it doesn't have an energy source that gets refilled basically by solar radiation. It has to do with materials that were kind of we've inherited in within the Earth, and at some point there's a limit to how many of those we can take out. So it's carbon-free, but not technically a renewable.
Thanks for that call, Ted. Let's go next to Donna in Cassville.
Good morning.
Hey, hi, Donna. You need to turn your radio off, please.
It is. It just went off.
Okay, great.
One comment that in the very early 60s, I had a boyfriend who ran his car on LP. And I understand that fuel systems now are a bit more complicated, but I'm sure that that sort of thing could be done. My real question is here, why are we not tapping the methane energy from our garbage dumps? I'd venture to say that every large city and every one of those countries has a problem with garbage. I know we're sending our garbage off to someplace else. Yeah, any of the landfills that you drive by, you see this flame dancing into the air, and that is gas, methane gas, that's coming out of there that has to be burned. So again, well, my question is, why are we not tapping those that natural resource?
Yeah, it's a good question. We should be doing more of that. But we are doing some of it. We are taking landfill gas, and instead of just burning it or venting it into the atmosphere, we're starting to use it as actual an energy source. And so that's changing. But what we probably need in order to do that is to put some more value on implementing those systems. Right now, those systems are pretty hard to do, or at least hard to justify for a very small scale, so a small municipality might have a hard time doing that. But they do make sense, and they do give you an energy source that you can use to offset natural gas or other fossil fuels. But once we actually have a greenhouse gas legislation that puts a price on emissions into the atmosphere, the price of putting methane especially into the atmosphere will go up quite a bit, because methane is a much more powerful gas than CO2 that comes from burning coal and gas or natural gas. So in that case, we'd have even stronger incentives. But the good side of it is we are starting to see capture of landfill gas for productive energy uses instead of just letting it go into the atmosphere or burning it.
Well, let's face it. A lot of these technologies are not going to be very attractive until the price of what we have been using, i.e. fossil fuels, gets a lot more expensive. I mean, I filled up my car with gas in near Milwaukee last Friday afternoon. I think I paid $2.45.9. And, you know, compared to the $4 a gallon that I was paying a year and a half ago, you know, it seemed relatively painless. It's a lot harder to sell people on alternatives that cost more when you can still buy coal and oil and natural gas relatively cheaply.
Absolutely. And I just say a couple of things on that is, one, absolutely, the prices do seem to affect behavior in a lot of different ways. And there is a real advantage of letting people make their own decisions about how they want to avoid very expensive energy, whether they want to invest in insulation in their homes, new windows, switching the types of vehicles they drive, or a municipality putting in a landfill gas capture system, something like that. So prices can make a big effect. A couple of problems, though, is that, one, prices that are set by governments in terms of making energy more expensive, if we're going to capture this sort of pollution cost of putting CO2 in the atmosphere, are vulnerable to people changing their minds about whether the problem is really that important and serious or not. And so it's a little bit different to have prices that are set by government intervention than it is to have prices that are set by, say, competing demands around the world for a limited fossil fuel or oil supply. So that's one thing we have to be careful about as well.
Let's see. Let's take a call from Dan in Liberty Pole. Hi, Dan.
Yes. I'd like to relate some of this global warming problem to agricultural policy. There are lots of scientists now that came to the conclusion that much of the excess carbon in the atmosphere, man-made anyway, is from our loss of topsoil. The organic matter in the topsoil becomes carbon, and it goes into the atmosphere. And you take a typical prairie soil, it was once 8 to 9% organic matter, and now they're farming it at 3% or less. That's a lot of carbon. And some are claiming this is the majority. And the solution would, you know, have to be a major change in agricultural policy, especially as it relates to animal agriculture, since so many of our crops go directly to animals for dairy or meat. And it would, we can replace that carbon in the soil relatively quickly through management-intensive grazing. But there's so many financial interests that would be hurt if we went to that type of animal agriculture that it seems impossible for me to see it happen very quickly.
Yeah, just that's a good point. I'd just like to make two comments on that. One is, again, if you look at the size of the problem globally and what we need to do, say, in the next 50 years to do something about it, doing something about agriculture and increasing the carbon content in soils does seem to be as big a solution as potentially renewables, nuclear, having one child instead of two. It's of that sort of scale. So it's one of those silver buckshot solutions. So certainly it's important. And so there does seem to be real potential there by just the way you till agriculture. The second part of the answer I just to this comment is your point about there's certain financial interests that would not like to see that happen. And that certainly is a problem throughout the climate policy debate. I think there's really two problems to do with climate policy not going forward. One is that it may make energy more expensive for everyone a little bit. For anyone that consumes energy, putting a price on greenhouse gas emissions, at least in the short term, is going to involve some kind of price increase, but it probably will be small and probably would be well worth it considering the damage that would come. A separate issue, though, is that there are concentrated interests that have a strong financial stake in not having climate change legislation go forward because the cost to them would be very, very large. They're especially carbon intensive, or they sell some type of device that relies on the way we do agriculture today or something like that. And those are two problems. The second one about this concentrated financial interest might be often considered not as legitimate, but the important part about that is that it's real, and it's not just going to go away because we think that we should do something about the problem. And so part of a solution to a good climate change agreement is going to somehow have to allay these very strong interests that have a large stake in a fossil fuel, carbon-intensive economy that we have today. And there are ways to do that, and it might not be that expensive to somehow get around their objections, but we need to be very clear and probably very creative from a policy design mechanism to find a way to get carbon-intensive industries, whether they're in agriculture or fossil fuels, on board as well.
The one of the people who spoke at the United Nations last week was Mohamed Nasheed, who is the president of the Maldives, a scattering of islands in the middle of the Indian Ocean. His message, he said to his fellow presidents, "You are not really listening." What kind of global cataclysm is it going to take before people really start to pay attention here?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I referred a little bit earlier to this statement that we've never had a really serious international agreement on environmental problems without the U.S. first having domestic legislation. Another aspect of that is we often seem to have some type of what's called a focusing event to catalyze action on it. And we, in the case of the ozone hole, it was sort of a picture of this hole that had developed over Antarctica that seemed to have a lot of traction that way. And, you know, if we think about what's happened to nuclear power in the last 20 years, the event that happened at Chernobyl seemed to have a very large impact on people's perceptions of the risks and dangers of that technology. The trick with climate change is, on the one hand, you want to have some type of event that would fall into that category to catalyze action, without it also indicating that it's kind of too late to do something about it, or that, you know, too many people get hurt because of what happened. And so you can imagine something happening that would not only be sort of a direct climate impact, but also could be well attributed to human emissions of greenhouse gases. And that's a little harder to figure out on climate change. So we may actually have to somehow come up with a negotiated solution and then start developing a way to change our way we use and produce energy in agriculture without actually having an event like that. Because in this particular situation, it might be too late by the time we've got that type of impact.
Thank you very, very much, Professor Nemeth, for joining us this morning. I really appreciate your time.
Sure, you bet.
Gregory Nemeth is Assistant Professor of Public Affairs and Environmental Studies at the La Follette School of Public Affairs at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Rhonda Fanning produced this program. Rob Schroeder handled on-air production. If you'd like to listen to it again, you can go to our website, WPR.org. Click on the Kathleen Dunn program, and there should be a link to the audio there sometime later today, I would imagine. Or you can call the radio store at 800-747-7444. And order a copy of the program 927E, as in environment. Stay tuned. Larry Mueller is in after the news. I'm John Munson, and for Kathleen Dunn, this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.